Well, it's another fantastic LSE audience. We're charging £50 a seat and it's still full. So it's very, very impressive. Actually, we should have charged, shouldn't we? £5 a seat and it would still be full. Anyway, you're all very welcome this evening. Thank you very much for coming. I'm sorry some of you are standing up there. I don't think there's much we can do about it. I don't know what the rules say about safety and keeping the corridors clear, but I'm sure they are rather important, so we can't fill up all the spaces here. But as far as I can tell, we are now packed. Well, welcome to the second Miliband lecture on American power in the 21st century, or perhaps we should now say American power in the 21st century brackets plus Britain, close brackets. A topic that gets more and more relevant and controversial each day. Well, the title of today's talk is also, you know, very much to the point, The New American Empire. I notice there's no question mark, was probably not one intended today. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Michael Cox. Before arriving here at the LSE to join the IR department in January, Professor Cox taught in the Department of International Politics at Aberystwyth, and before that at the Department of Politics at Queen's University of Belfast. Currently, apart from being a professor here, he is a research fellow at Chatham House and sits on the National Committee for the Study of International Affairs in the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin. Between 1998 and 2002, he was the editor of the Review of International Studies, that's the leading British IR journal, I should say. It doesn't say it in his vita, but I would say the outstanding editor of the Review of International Studies, and made that journal, you know, something that most of us wanted to read, and we have to confess we didn't read it regularly before your editorship. And he was also, until last year, editor of International Relations and director of the David Davis Memorial Institute. So you've given up quite a lot of things recently.
I have. It's sacrificed.
So I'm glad you have done, so you made time for today's lecture. He has published widely in many different areas. Over the past, I just want to mention, of course, expertise in relation to today. Over the past few years, his main focus of attention has been on the United States. In 1995, he completed US foreign policy after the Cold War, superpower at the crossroads, or we can safely say now it's crossed the crossroads.
It's the crossroads, yeah.
And 5 years later, American Democracy Promotion, which was published by OUP. He's now working on the theme of American foreign policy discourse and American foreign policy after 9/11. So what will today be surely a contrasting talk with that of Joe Nye. So please join me welcoming Professor Cox.
Thank you very much, David, for that introduction. I'm not sure if the lecture should have had a question mark or not. I'll know at the end of the lecture when I finished it. In other words, I think this is one still open for debate and discussion. So it isn't quite as assertive as it appears there. David also said I'm probably bound to be different to Joe Nye. Well, I suppose I am bound to be different to Joe Nye. And take a rather different perspective on this, and those who attended Professor Nye's excellent lecture will, I think, spot the difference rather quickly. The significance of 9/11, I think, can be most easily and readily measured, not in the more basic humanitarian terms of counting how many people died on that Tuesday morning in September 2001, but from a global perspective and from an international relations perspective, but in relationship to something else altogether, not denying the importance of humanitarian considerations, but it's something else that draws us all here today, to be perfectly honest. And what draws us here is a discussion about its results and its consequences at home and abroad. And if we look at 9/11 in this particularly brutal way, you might say, one thing becomes manifestly obvious, or at least I'm bound to say that, because it proves me right. And what becomes obvious is this, that those who argued at the time, and have argued since, that September the 11th would turn out to be a world historic event, which should not be underestimated or downplayed, have turned out to be more right, more correct, than those many pundits at the time, mainly to be found in Europe, who suggested we should not get too worked up by what happened on 9/11. That the significance of 9/11 should not be exaggerated. I heard that many times. And finally, that we should not draw any phony or false historical analogies with other great historical events of the past. A concern and worry, of course, which we all bound to share. Well, Fred Halliday, my colleague, new colleague, old friend, here at London School of Economics, put it very nicely in his book on 9/11, that when faced with really big events in history, there is always a tendency to either imply that nothing has changed. By the way, I know a lot of writers who write about 1989 and 1991 who still think that not much has changed as a result of the end of the Cold War, or to suggest that everything has changed. Well, clearly, not everything has changed. Nothing ever does. But a great deal has, and no doubt much more will in the future. And let me just quickly punch in some of the key obvious changes which have occurred because of 9/11. And we do need to be reminded of this. First, and most obviously, one war has already been fought, and another war is going to be very soon. A major rift, though how serious, has occurred in the transatlantic relationship. Again, how serious and deep and profound that rift is, we shall see. But no doubt, all the headlines over the last 2 to 3 weeks do tell us something about the knock-on effect, the indirect knock-on effect of 9/11 onto the relationship across the Atlantic. The worst crisis since Pershing and Pershing II, for those of you who can remember what Pershing II actually was back in the early days of the 1980s. Thirdly, and for some more worryingly perhaps, the cause of Europe and even the definition of what Europe is has been thrown into turmoil. And not just because of Donald Rumsfeld's discovery of that old Europe, contrasting it with the much better, shinier, newer Europe. Clearly, Europe itself has come under scrutiny in the days and weeks and months since 9/11, and particularly in the light of what is happening over Iraq. Fourthly, more generally, although again this is debated hotly by economists, and if it's debated hotly by economists, then you can imagine it must be important. The world economy has been severely impacted. Now again, I've been watching them on the TV over the last few weeks, how much the war itself, the impending war, how much 9/11 more generally, has caused the downturn in the stock markets. Of course, they all say it hasn't, because most of them don't know much about the real world. But I think there is a general view, a general acceptance, the coming when it did, as it did, in the way in which it did, and the shocking consequences, and where the targets happened to be, then clearly there has been a knock-on and recessionary effect on the overall world economy. And clearly that point would be debated too in terms and in context of the war against Iraq. And fifthly, and more generally, one could say, that politics in many countries, I think as well, has also been changed. Perhaps not as greatly as has politics been changed since the end of the Cold War, when the notions of right and left have been thrown clearly into sharp relief, and some would even worry or can be concerned that these categories of right and left now no longer mean very much in the post-Cold War context. But politics has also been changed by post 9/11. And how it has been changed has been to thoroughly securitize the very nature of politics in ways, I think, quite reminiscent of the early Cold War. Fears abound throughout the world about potential attack from without, connected to potential unknown
threats from within. This is very reminiscent, as I think has been pointed out by many people, of the early days of the Cold War. Again, beware historical analogies and beware historians bearing them. We are not in an age of McCarthy. The House of Un-American Activities has not been restored in the United States. You may have noticed all that. Nevertheless, one would be blind to the fact of this securitization, or what I call securitization, very reminiscent of the early Cold War days of political life, not just in America, but in Europe, but particularly and especially in the United States. Indeed, when I was there last time, I was quite struck by how many of the debates about everything else, whether it was about environment, whether it was about the economy, whether it was about visas, whether it was about travel and immigration, all came back to the one issue of terrorism. And this, again, is very much like the Cold War, the way in which every single issue of a multifarious character gets drawn and sucked into a sort of single narrative. And I think that has occurred, though less in Europe, though certainly more obviously in the United States. So these are the more general consequences of 9/11, and one could go on and add many more. But it is in the United States, not surprisingly, that the impact of 9/11 has been greatest, and by a serious measure, I've always argued and will continue to argue. And perhaps we, on this side of the Atlantic, need to be reminded of what changes have occurred on the other side of the Atlantic, over there, over the past 18 months or so. First, at home, in America. First, at the most trivial level, a presidency and a particular president has been saved for the time being. I don't want to go back to the election of 2000, the hanging or swinging chads and all the rest of it, but clearly this was a flawed presidency from the very beginning, whatever your political coloration, and what 9/11 has done has been to transform this president and this presidency, although for how long remains to be seen, but it is a fact. Secondly, a bureaucratic revolution has taken place within the bureaucracy with the formation of Homeland Security. And again, when you ever get any great turning points in foreign policy, in America or elsewhere, and particularly in America, if you look at the history of American foreign policy, you'll always see this accompanied by great bureaucratic changes. The CIA and all the rest of it, the national security apparatus, was created at the very beginning of the Cold War. And now we are seeing similar types of bureaucratic changes, perhaps not as significant, now taking place in the wake of 9/11. Added to this, one again would be blind not to see a wave of patriotism sweeping across America, although immediately in the wake of 9/11, the chanting of USA, USA, the singing of the anthem and other songs, which has reminded Americans, and certainly reminded many people outside of America, that America is indeed different. And certainly one has seen an extraordinary reassertion of that thing called identity, an American identity, in the past few months and since 9/11. One could also argue, and I think one again could debate this point, but liberalism, even in its modified form by the end of the 1990s, has been thrown onto the defensive in the United States because of 9/11. One might even go further, although some might not, and even suggest that something close to a war psychosis exists now in the United States. One doesn't want to exaggerate, one doesn't want to draw false analogies, but it's difficult not to see these things. A wave of patriotism, a patriotic act even was passed in the wake of 9/11. Those opposed to the president can easily be labeled, although are not very often, but are sometimes labeled, as being distinctly un-American, and if you're not with us, you are against us. America, in other words, has gone through, I think, a thoroughgoing American type of perestroika. This has not eliminated discussion, it has not stopped America being a liberal democratic country, it has not prevented debates about American foreign policy. And you might argue quite openly that the debate is far more open now than it has been for a long time. Nevertheless, the changes, it seems to me, are real, manifest, and measurable. But it's in terms of America's position in the world, I think, that the results have perhaps been most dramatic. And let me just outline four. Most obviously,
9/11 and its outcomes and its results and consequences has only further increased the so-called military capability gap between the United States and the rest of the world. However you try to spin it, however you try to measure it, and I know that people find measuring American military spending is a highly problematic exercise. I'm told it's all inflation anyway. But nevertheless, a country such as the United States today is spending close to $380 billion per annum on national security, on defense, and even that doesn't measure all of it, by the way, with a plan for this to rise by about 20% in real terms over the next 4 years. This is a level of military spending of Reaganite epic proportions, and certainly the rises are. And more significantly too, whilst we in Europe dither, if you like, about what to do about closing that gap, the Americans are busily making that gap even wider. It has also made possible, 9/11 and the subsequent crises which have flowed from that, because that is essentially what we're in, a permanent crisis. It isn't something which happened and then ended. It is a permanent crisis. And where it ends, I frankly do not know. And I think this is what is so both interesting and worrying about the present situation. But what it has also done is made possible something of a doctrinal revolution in military affairs. And this was outlined quite clearly, fairly unambiguously last year in the National Strategic Review, published in, I think, September or October. And now, without going into all the details of that particular document, what came out of that, of course, was one single central argument, that you did not define security in terms of the threats against you, but in terms of preemption. As we used to say in rugby, you get your retaliation in first. Or to put it in more geostrategic or global terms, you intervene when and where you like, on the assumption that a threat might arise at some point in the future. Now again, this is not entirely original, it's not entirely new. Great powers have always done it in the past, and America has often done it in the past as well. But nevertheless, there it is in black and white, a doctrine of preemption, which is in some senses a doctrine of early intervention even before the threat has become manifest, clear, and obvious. And clearly it is the doctrine of preemption which is shaping the American view towards Iraq. It isn't the case that Iraq may or may not have its nuclear weapons. It is that it may obtain these at some point in the future, and thus in the National Strategic Review, it is entirely legitimate to preempt it obtaining these weapons and thus becoming a threat at some point in the future, and think through the logic of that to other situations as well. And what that means, if that has now become the broad doctrine of the Pentagon and of a large swathe of the American foreign policy establishment, or a particular group within that establishment. And I don't believe that is the whole story, but it is a large part of that story today. I think one should also accept that as a result of 9/11, and indeed President Bush, I thought, rather too openly conceded this, or stated it, that 9/11 was not only a tragedy, not only a challenge, but it also, as he, to use his own words, was an opportunity. In other words, it presented something of an upside and presented the United States with a real chance to reorder the world and deal with a number of outstanding problems. People have been asking today, what is the connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda? Well, perhaps there isn't one. But 5 days after September the 11th, Iraq had become defined as a problem and something to be dealt with. And that was only 5 days after September 11th. Read the Bob Woodward book. And everybody knew that the connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq was tenuous, if non-existent. So 9/11 opened up a possibility of thinking about other things more creatively. To deal with a number of outstanding problems, some of them, like Iraq, only loosely related to the war against terrorism. And finally, and here's where my left wing stuff comes in, just in case, just to make you know it's coming. Here comes my conspiracy theory. 9/11, I also think, has presented a very special opportunity to a number of key thinkers on the conservative right, who languished during the dark, dismal days of Bill Clinton and Hillary. And how awful those days were for the neoconservatives in America. You can't explain part of what is happening today inside the United States and outside, except as revenge on the Clinton 8 years. In effect, many of these people, many of them themselves, had been experienced foreign policy personnel in the 70s and certainly in the early 80s under Reagan, have come out of their various think tanks and universities to implement their own vision, their own global strategy, if you like. This is a very un-British thing to think about, actually. It sounds like a conspiracy theory. In fact, it sounds terribly conspiratorial. All I would say, I think it's very American. And it's not, after all, the first time in history where a major crisis, a real crisis, not an invented crisis, not an imaginary crisis, but a real crisis, has also opened up possibilities of thinking creatively about US global strategy. For all those who know the history of the early Cold War, you'll know very well that the Korean War was real. It wasn't imaginary. It happened. It wasn't some sort of postmodern fantasy. But it provided the framework, the opportunity to think creatively about American grand strategy. And that came out, of course, in the famous NSC 68. As Dean Acheson later said, NSC 68 may have been buried but for Korea. And again, if we move the argument on to the late 1970s, there were many conservatives throughout the 1970s during the so-called period of détente, the so-called decade of neglect, as it was then characterized and caricatured, who were deeply unhappy about the drift in American foreign policy during the 70s, first under Kissinger, then under Ford, and then under the deeply unfortunate Jimmy Carter. And what provided them with their opportunity, their possibility, was Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan was not a plot. It was not thought up in the Pentagon. It happened because of the Soviet Union, but it provided again this opportunity for a neoconservative global strategy. And I think the same is happening today. Don't believe me? Go to the websites. They're all over the place. And the story is well told on those websites and told through the literature from the AEI and the Heritage. And what the story says is something like this, and I'll simply repeat it in brief. Namely, that throughout the 1990s, the United States languished. So it is argued. It threw away all the advantages it had accrued by virtue of winning the Cold War, basically. Moreover, it had been sucked into all sorts of international agreements that had limited its freedom of action, that had constrained it. In the process, it had abdicated leadership in favor of the feel-good, very Clinton feel-good global politics of multilateralism, and this sticks deeply in the core of most neoconservatives, of humanitarian intervention. In this process as well, its highly trained, well-paid soldiers, who are basically designed to kill, had been turned into overpaid and overtrained social workers doing nice things in other countries like Bosnia and the like. And, horrible horrors, military spending had been allowed to fall as a percentage of US gross national product. And to quote a letter sent to the new President Bush when he had come to office, an increasingly dangerous gap, it was argued, had opened up between our strategic ends and our military means. And these, by the way, were not insignificant figures. These are figures today who are shaping US foreign policy. One, by the way, will be coming here to speak next time, Robert Kagan. Now, in this context, if I painted the context and the picture accurately, which I'm bound to say I think I have, although you may disagree with it, where the United States appears to be more willing than ever to use military force abroad, to project force, and to do so with or without the support of all of its allies, indeed to view its allies as a problem to be dealt with, managed, rather than friends to be consulted, When, in short, the United States appears after post 9/11 and today to be so self-confident and assertive, it is not so surprising that many analysts of the international scene have been forced to reconsider some old conceptions and rethink what it is exactly we are actually gazing upon when we gaze upon the United States in its current form. It has all come as something of a shock, if I might say so, especially to liberals. After all, I think many liberals really did think that a new world shaped by global markets and international institutions was coming into being in the 1990s. No more. Suddenly, the old problem of power and its evident maldistribution in the world of states with conflicting and clashing interests has come right back onto the international stage. No wonder tough old realists are all walking around with a smile on their face these days. Their time seems to have come. But something else has happened too these past few months. A new kind of discussion has arisen about something which 10 years ago would have been seen as perverse and 25 as laughable. And that debate has focused on the notion of empire. Or more precisely, whether or not this long-abandoned concept in the social and political sciences should be dusted down and taken out of its intellectual tomb, where it had been consigned by the 20th century, to see if it is perhaps a more useful tool for understanding the United States today than any other tool of analysis. Indeed, the more you look around, and in the process of writing this lecture I had to look around quite a lot, the more you discover how much in vogue the idea of a new American empire has suddenly become amongst the chattering classes. That which was distinctly unfashionable before, a bit like flared trousers, has rather quickly become quite central to the modern discussion about the United States. And not just on the radical left, where it never went away. In fact, more generally, empire seems to be back in fashion. Everywhere one turns these days, there's empire or talk about it. Some of this, of course, is of the distinctly nostalgic variety. I know many an historian who thinks the world started to go wrong when Austro-Hungary collapsed in 1918. But there are many more serious historical studies about empires in general. And Niall Ferguson, I'm informed, has made a mint talking about the British Empire on TV. But it is the idea of a new American empire which is exciting most interest these days. This was summed up very well in a recent review of a book on, guess what, Spain's Road to Empire, recently reviewed in the Times Literary Supplement. Ronald Wright, the reviewer, expressed the new mood rather well in the TLS last December, and I quote, and it's a rather good quote, so if you don't mind, "Those who by virtue of age," and I suppose that includes me, "and sobriety," and that doesn't include me, "can remember the 1960s and may recall that term, the American Empire, as a bit of left-wing cant." Cant with a C, by the way. Just in case. Later the right wing, of course, described the Soviet Union as an evil empire. But both sides landed their punches by anachronism, linking modern political structures to supposedly crude despotism from the marble and sepia past. How recently we believe the age of empire was dead. How recently we thought the nation state would blend into a new multilateralism, leading to something like the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World, dreamt by Tennyson in 1842. Perhaps not everyone was ready to cheer the sprouting of a worldwide Brussels. Good stuff this, eh? But the end of the Cold War made it seem inevitable and preferable to anything tried before. Now, with the Bush doctrine of preemptive war and full spectrum dominance, great.
It appears that fresh blood is dripping into the coffin of imperialism, and the occupant may yet spring back to life.
I wish I could write like that, or maybe I don't.
But Wright is by no means the only personal writer to detect a sea change in intellectual mood concerning our ways about thinking about the United States in the modern world. Others have also joined in the hunt. And one who is normally very much ahead of the pack and who in the past has helped shape and define many intellectual trends has been Michael Ignatieff. And in a typical brilliant tour de force, Ignatieff not only noted the new imperial focus amongst many writers, but expressed it very forcefully himself. True, he argued, the American empire may not be like empires of times past. There are, after all, different forms of globalization as well. The 21st century imperium, he agreed, was a new invention in the annals of political science. However, America, in terms of its global role and international function of enforcing such order as there was in the world, was by any measure an empire. What was different about the US empire, he went on, was not that it did not exist, but rather that most Americans actually denied it existed. As he put it, and again I quote, although this is a little less bloody than the last one, quote, the historian J.R. Seeley once remarked that Britain had acquired an empire in a fit of absent-mindedness. If Americans have an empire, according to Ignatieff, they have acquired it in a state of denial. And as he went on to point out, nobody was keener to deny it than President Bush himself. As Bush insisted in a speech to cadets at West Point last June 2002, America has no empire to extend, said President Bush, or, interestingly, utopia to establish. Interesting one, that. And speaking to veterans at the White House in November, President Bush repeated the point, just in case others, or President Bush, had forgotten it. Sorry, I had to get one cheap smack in there. That will be the last one to all Republicans abroad. America, said Bush, has no territorial ambitions. We don't seek an empire. Our nation is committed to freedom for ourselves and for others. One could go on. The list of modern writers who now accept, or the number who accept that we might well be confronting a new American imperium could be extended almost ad infinitum. In fact, at different times over the past few months, over the last year, a whole host of analysts from Anatole Levin right through to John Eikenberry have been forced to come to terms with the phenomenon. And before them, it was John Hart and Antonio Negri in their best-selling work on empire. It was a best-selling work. Moreover, there's a ready willingness now, I would argue, which was not apparent before, to accept the term as a legitimate one in the discourse about America. Ignatieff, in fact, asks the obvious question, well, what else is there? As he notes. Yet what word but empire describes the awesome thing that America is becoming? It is, after all, the only nation that polices the world through five global military commands, maintains more than 1 million men and women at arms on four continents, guarantees the survival of many countries around the world which otherwise may not survive, including Israel and South Korea, drives the wheel of global trade and commerce, and fills the hearts and minds of the planet with its dreams and desires. So empire is back. Talk of a new American empire, as I say, has become fashionable once again. It has become, in a sense, part of the cutting edge of the debate in America post 9/11 and in the context of what is happening in Iraq. And in what follows, I want to tackle the modern phenomenon of the American empire, with or without a question mark, I'll leave that up to you, as it has been so characterized, by looking at three problems. One, an historical problem about the United States well before 9/11. Another, more analytical about the term itself, because I'm bound to be asked, well, is it? And another, more futurological issue about the prospects for this entity known as the American Empire. First, some history of the potted variety. And my points are rather simple and basic, but I think important nonetheless. Point number one is that there's nothing especially new about the American Empire, if we accept the term anyway. And to talk of it as if it was something novel, as many people have been doing over the last year or two, it seems to be highly misleading. Certainly American leaders throughout a large part of the 20th century thought imperially, or globally. Some would even argue that the idea of empire, however informal, however indirect, however non-territorial, is something that could be traced back to the 1890s and the great crisis of 1898, when the United States engaged in quite a bit of aggressive imperialism, by the way, against the crumbling Spanish Empire. Even that nice man Woodrow Wilson at Versailles had a vision which was global. So too, more obviously, did the even more misunderstood Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. Furthermore, one could ask, what else did the United States create during the Cold War itself but some form of imperium with Washington as Rome? Don't forget either how many of those who led the United States in the Cold War were informed by, reflected upon, and drew lessons from a past. They were not tabula rasa in 1944, or 45, or 46, or 47, or 48. And what did they draw from? They drew from the British imperial past. That was one of the most important lessons they drew. It wasn't the only one, but it was a serious one. And the lesson they learned, and they talked about, and Acheson and others were quite explicit about this, was critical. That in the end, you will not get international order, global order. You will not get peace, stability, a pax, without one major hegemon, one major power, a superpower, whatever you want to call it, underwriting order, paying the bills, and doing the dirty work when necessary. Often this word was not used hegemony, it was called leadership. But leadership was another word for hegemony. So there's nothing very new about the American Empire in that sense. If we're going to talk about it, we need to go back in time. That is all I'm suggesting. The second point of history, potted again, concerns what happened to this hegemon, this Pax Americana, as it became quite often referred to, obviously drawing the parallel with Pax Britannica of the 19th century. And here we confront a most extraordinary phenomenon, which I've written about elsewhere at some length. And this concerns the apparent demise of the empire from the late 1960s onwards. I won't go into all the detail about what turned out to be a long and extended debate. Suffice to say here that the overwhelming consensus amongst a whole host of writers from the 1960s onwards, from liberals to realists, right across the political spectrum to the Marxist left, was that although the United States may have been a mighty empire once, and particularly in that critical period, 45 to 1970, after 1970, it was going the way of all other great powers and doing what other great powers had done in the past, and that was to decline. Vietnam, economic competition from other sources, fiscal deficits, all the rest added together to a consensus right across the board, except for a very few. Now, some, of course, applauded American decline. Liberals and the left certainly did. Others argued the United States should adjust to decline. One could explain, I think, largely Kissinger's foreign policy in those terms. Others tried to reverse that decline. President Reagan. Indeed, Reagan himself was quite clear. Part of the large picture within which he was operating was a notion of American decline and that it was essential to reverse this. But there was no doubting the process, the direction, and the direction it was argued for a period at least was broadly speaking downwards. And this all came to a head, of course, with Paul Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, published in 1988. What made the Kennedy book such a bestseller, 100,000 hardbacks, we all know the history, and also the figures, was that he not only piled on heaps of history and learning and stacks of analogies and had a simple thesis of overstretch, but the Kennedy thesis, so-called, about American decline, relative or otherwise, tapped into a pre-existing acceptance of the idea that America was going the way of other great powers. Then, and this is my last historical point, potted, something very odd happened. though whether it happened in the real world or in the minds of intellectuals remains a disputed question. And as we all know, the minds of intellectuals is far more important than the real world. But something happened, if you like. The tide turned. And this is my third point of instant history for you. The United States came back. Whether or not it had ever been in decline in the first place, of course, is a moot question. This was much debated amongst many people for over 20 years and made many jobs, many tenure decisions, and all the rest of it. Doesn't matter. The United States came back or appeared to come back from a long period of relative or real decline. It did not go the way of other great powers, in other words. It didn't do what Spain or Holland or Portugal or indeed Britain had done and declined gently. Why? A variety of reasons. The end of the Cold War brought about the collapse of the alternative, the economic alternative of planning. It removed a distinct ideological threat and led to the possibility, for the first time, of a truly open world economy. Globalization in its modern form, I think, is somewhat inconceivable without the events of 1989 and 1991. This was followed by the collapse of the USSR, the end of bipolarity, as it had been defined. But there was far more than just the events of 1989 to 1991. Think of many of the assumptions which were held in 1989 and 1991 about other things in the world, and think how much of that didn't come true by the end of the decade. I was asked the question, whatever happened to the Pacific century? If you remember, throughout the 80s, the larger threat to the United States, according to some people, wasn't the Soviet Union, but Japan. Well, whatever happened to that particular problematic threat? And clearly, the decline of Japan economically, the financial crisis associated with Japan, has created a certain sense of self-confidence. The American model works, and this putative alternative in the shape of Japan has failed. One might also say, and I'm seeing William Wallace looking at me now, but I have to say this, William, whatever happened to Europe? The year of Europe, the decade of Europe. Again, I'm not a great Eurosceptic, but clearly the contrast between the aspirations of Europe, common foreign and defence policy and all the rest, contrast that then with the end of the 1990s. Now again, much of this may be in perception, much of this may be American hubris. Clearly what happened to in former Yugoslavia informs a certain type of American view that America always gets it right and the Europeans are always supposed to get it wrong. Dayton is where the peace process was signed, not Berlin, not Rome, not London, not Paris. And that has sent out a huge message, and it's one which has been internalized by many, many Americans. It's, by the way, something which still informs their thinking about Europe today. We might also ask another whatever happened question, whatever happened to American economic decline? Now again, the reasons why and the causes of the resurgence of the American economy through the larger part of the 1990s, easy to forget it now, of course, after 3 years of stock market decline. But for 109 consecutive months, it went up. Employment more or less became full. American industry came back. It is true, of course, that military spending, as American conservatives would argue, that percentage of US GNP fell. That is obviously true, but this is a gimmick. Of course, the percentage of military spending, as measured as part of a percentage of US GNP, fell throughout the 1990s, but gross national product more or less doubled throughout the 1990s. So you're not measuring the same thing at all. And it was a huge GNP. And by the way, the percentage was still higher, more or less, than the other powers. So by the end of the 1990s, not long before 2001, remember, and this, by the way, was under appalling liberal Clinton, this man who was undermining the moral and political and strategic fabric of the free world. It was under Clinton in those 8 years. But by the end of his presidency, one could argue, and I would argue, that America's military position was more secure, more dominant, than it had probably ever been before. Partly because US GNP had gone up and the percentage of spending with it, partly because the rest of the world's military spending had gone down, particularly in Europe, or hadn't been sustained to the same level, and partly, of course, going back to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Not surprisingly, as a result of all these multiple changes from the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Pacific Dream, the problems of Europe, American economic decline, and all the rest, suddenly book titles changed. Paul Kennedy even changed. And from Spenglerian doom of the late 1980s and the 70s, suddenly there was sunshine everywhere. Optimism everywhere. Unbelievable. And this, by the way, coming towards the end of that appalling presidency of that appalling man, Mr. Bill Clinton, and his decliners. This man deliberately trying to undermine the fabric of America. What sort of book titles were coming out of the bookstores? What sort of articles were being written in their increasing numbers? Nothing about relative decline, nothing about the fall of the American Empire any longer. You couldn't sell that sort of title to an American publisher by 2000. I tell you what, if Paul Kennedy had gone along with that title in 2000, he wouldn't have sold 100,000 hardback copies. The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, including America. They'd say, go back, get a PhD. Or not. Bruce Cummings, an old friend of mine from Chicago, a good old American radical, what's he writing about now? Still the American century. Book after book, the American century will be, the 21st century will be American too. There's sort of two fingers aspect, some of them, you know. A total reverse, and so on and so forth. And all this. And let us not forget all this before 9/11. All this before Bush. And all of this, of course, puts 9/11 into some proper historical perspective. Sorry to rattle on about history, but I do think it is important here. Yes, of course, the world changed dramatically because of 9/11. I emphasize that. The United States was presented with an opportunity. The mood also shifted dramatically within the United States itself. All this is obvious. But what did not change, although it is changing with the military spending increases and the change in doctrinal revolution, what did not change in some fundamental sense was the basic correlates of power. Indeed, you might say what's happened since 9/11 is simply an acceleration of a trend which was already there throughout the 1990s. This brings me then to the second big point about the term itself and its appropriateness. As we have suggested earlier, the term empire has become popular since 9/11. However, it was not popular before. Indeed, many would insist that it is and has always been a most inappropriate term to describe the United States as a world power. Call it anything else, but don't call it an empire. Call it a superpower, maybe even call it a hegemon. Use terms like unipolarity, but you can't call it an empire. Why? Why this denial? Why this problem with the term? I don't think there's a conspiracy here, but I do think there's some politics involved. I think part of the denial is political. I mean, let's be honest, empires are not PC, if I might put it rather bluntly. Historically, empires have been delegitimized in some way. We might write about them a lot. We might hanker after them. If we're Roger Scruton, we might think they were wonderful things. I don't know. But empires are not regarded as being too PC these days. You know, the history of the 20th century is a history of the decline of these things called empires. After all, empires deny self-determination. They deny democracy. You can't have an empire which has self-determination and democracy, one would argue. And they imply oppression. So who's going to own up to being an empire? Oh, yeah, we're an empire. So there's a political problem, because the 20th century has done such damage to the term itself. America, too, has very special reasons, as indeed Ignatieff pointed out, to deny that it is an empire. Very special reasons. I mean, you won't find the Brits saying it wasn't an empire. They might say it fell apart or collapsed or did all sorts of other things, but they can hardly deny there was one. But the Americans, it seems, the United States, many United States, at least not all, have very special reasons to deny empire. Why? For very obvious reasons. America, after all, arose out of a struggle against an empire, or the British. Ideologically, it has always been opposed to empires, at least European colonial empires. It has an anti-imperialist mission, or an anti-colonial one. And as everybody reminds us, including President Bush, the United States has had few territorial ambitions in history, except, of course, to conquer America itself, which was quite a territorial undertaking if you've been sitting in America in 1800. That looked a pretty good bit of territory to conquer, I would have thought. Empty space, of course. So, sorry about that little snide. So how can one call it an empire? Well, those are reasonable points, although not entirely reasonable. I think there are other more mainstream, what I call academic objections, and David's going to come in here, by the way. So, David, I do apologise now. It's very bad you get invited by somebody to talk and then you can make a point about it later on. But anyway, I think the two fundamental objections, I suppose, which raise the whole question of the definition and use of the term. One, of course, has been raised implicitly by the Norwegian historian Geir Lundestad, who I worked with last year at the Nobel Institute. I thought I'd just drop that one in. Just to prove there was life after Aberystwyth and before the LSE. And Geir Lundestad raises this point, of course, that if one looks at the United States, Geir Lundestad doesn't mind using the term empire, in inverted commas, but it's always empire by invitation. And one might argue that the American empire, so-called, has more often not been by invitation, not by imposition. Can this really, therefore, be defined as an empire? I think that is an interesting question. And there are many things also, and this in a sense is the more substantive argument, where David comes in. One could also argue it is not an empire, and this is certainly how it's been argued, it cannot be called an empire because it cannot control all events whose outcome it cannot determine. It may have a lot of power, but it doesn't have the ability to shape outcomes. Put another way, one talks about empire implying what the United States can do, or what the United States possesses as power, as raw power, but what about those things it cannot do? The limits. Again, this almost looks like I'm attacking all my colleagues at the LSE, so I now apologise to Anthony Giddens, David Held and Mary Calder. But I thought I'd mention them anyway. Anthony Giddens, for instance, I think his book on... one of his books, anyway, he writes so many. Just talk to the United States being hemmed in and not being able to control modern financial markets. And it's quite clear from that. He feels that, in a sense, denies, therefore, the word empire, or at least suggests that. I think David, I think, accepts the enormous structural power of the United States and has talked eloquently, as normal, of a potential for global hegemony following the end of the Cold War. But I think, David, you argue, or at least have argued, whether you've changed your mind, I don't know, but that this potential and power is deeply inscribed into the functioning of the present world order. And more recently, Mary Caldor, in an excellent piece published in International Affairs, also takes the new imperialist to task. As Mary puts it, if America were truly an empire, surely it would be able to extend democracy to other regions, to impose its system on the rest of the world. And she concludes, and I think makes an excellent point, not too dissimilar to what David and Tony have said, the United States has the ability to be immensely destructive, but much less capability to do compellence. Now, how to respond to these various objections, and I haven't even begun to list them all. Let me take the invitation issue first. I think it's an interesting one. I mean, even if we accept that America is an empire by invitation, and by the way, many living in the third world would not, it's a very European perspective, I think, to some degree. I think it only modifies the argument, but I don't think it sinks it altogether. True, most empires in the past have been imposed in the first instance. I mean, India did not say to the British, please come in, you know. Same is true largely of Africa. And let's for the moment accept that the American empire was not imposed. It was by invitation, at least particularly and especially in Western Europe. But I don't think the story ends there. You then have to explain why empires in general, particularly successful empires, have lasted over time. Which I think makes the analogy more useful. And here I think the imperial analogy makes a lot of sense. After all, the more successful empires in history did not last as long as they did because of force alone, because of power alone, because of fear alone. That is why the Soviet Empire was so unsuccessful and so short-lived. Even Rome did not survive all those centuries by sheer force. Many of its various subjects actually preferred being inside the imperium, protected by Roman law and order, than being outside of it. For those of you who can remember the life of Brian, you remember the famous discussion between the two Trotskyist groups in Palestine in 400 BC, What's the Roman Empire ever done for us, comrades? And after listing all the 10 things which the Roman Empire done, and what else has the Roman Empire done for us, comrades? Well, in a sense, the same type of thing may be said about the United States. Better to be under its protection, within its circuit, within its framework, and let it pay most of the bills of cost in terms of the military bills, than being outside of it. Indeed, you might say that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the collapse of the alternative, after the collapse of actually existing socialism, where else in the modern world is there to go? Where is the point of destination for any state outside of that? I'm not so sure. On the question of limits, let me just briefly go through this. I think some of these are often exaggerated. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Maybe I see the power and other people see the limits. What we have to do is marry the two together. That's a fair point. We can talk about that. But let me make a more substantive point. Because American control is limited, does not mean we should not call it an empire. All empires in the past have had their limits, but we could still call them empires. But the really intriguing issue, it seems to me, is not this one, but rather something else, namely, whether or not the United States actually has more reach, far fewer limits, than its various predecessors, which people often don't like to compare them with. Greece and Rome, recall, were all highly circumscribed in their reach by technology and the level of economic development. The United States is not. It has truly global reach in ways that no other empire in the past, with maybe the exception of the British, never had. Let me just also make two other points by way of defense of the term, or by way of at least argument or suggestion that it may indeed be a very appropriate way of thinking about America. Note, firstly, that all empires in the past suffered and declined precisely because they appeared to run against the flow of history in the 20th century. Self-determination, the notion of a legitimate national self-determination, ultimately weakened and undermined notions of empire. It delegitimized it. Surely the real power of the United States is that it runs with the flow, not against it, certainly in terms of liberal ideas, the market, and ultimately democracy. Now, this may be far too Hegelian for most people, far too teleological, but I don't see any alternatives knocking around at the moment. And America runs with that flow and not against it. That's one of my points. And I think that gives it enormous leverage. That gives it enormous influence. And it gives it enormous positional strength, as well as international dimension of power. The other point I'd simply try and make is that don't forget either other great empires in the past have gone under because of military defeat or because they could not carry the cost of being an empire. Churchill had this wonderful phrase in 1918, when empires fell through the air like so much drizzle. Fantastic. Well, I don't see this happening to the United States. War in the 20th century has strengthened America, not weakened it. Two world wars created the conditions of Pax Americana while weakening the others. So yes, there are possible objections, and I'm quite prepared to discuss them while refuting them, to the term itself. But I still think we lose much. I still think we lose much by not using the term empire, both in terms of what it suggests about America today and helps us think creatively about historical analogy. And I suppose also as an historian, I think sort of going away from the script here, I think we lose so much by not drawing in these useful comparisons. Analogies do not always have to be wrong ones. Anyway, this brings me to the last part of the lecture, to the issue of the future. And this is where, of course, I get it completely wrong. Thus far, of course, I've been absolutely right, as you know. It brings me to the future of this new or not so new entity called the American Empire. Here again, I take issue with the normal way that this future has been plotted by those who take it for granted that history is bound to repeat itself. and that because all empires have gone under in the past, the American empire is bound to go under as well. I think we have to think outside the normal historical loop and not be mesmerized or overwhelmed by the past, even though I claim to be an historian. Perhaps we have to accept that the United States is the exception, that it is significantly different, but that the structure of its power position, its global influence, all the things that Ignatieff and many others have talked about, are new and are real, and that it may be far more secure than anything else known in the past. This, by the way, was a point made by Susan Strange in this university. She never thought the United States was ever in decline, and who had no problem, by the way, in calling it an empire. We can also tackle the problem from an empirical point of view. Who or what rises up to balance this power, this empire, perhaps even replace it? Well, the USSR tried and failed. China is often seen as a candidate in the next 50 years. Who can tell? But those who know more about China than I do either seem to be talking about its further integration into the world market, shaped by the WTO and all the rest of it, of course, of which the United States is a rather important player, or, in fact, according to some of them, even its disintegration as it tries to deal with the problems of mixing political sclerosis with economic dynamism. But who else? Where else? Europe? Even less so of a threat. The Middle East? I don't think so. Islam, terrorism, Iraq? Simply by listing the possible challenges or the very real threats makes the point clearer than the truth, it seems to me. Indeed, one of the great paradoxes of American power is that it is never so self-confident as when it is under challenge. There is this huge mobilizational capacity within the United States and outside, which we have seen since 9/11. Basically, to cut a very long story short, the world is now truly unipolar, I think, with little possibility of that changing. And by the way, the United States will take all active measures to ensure that it remains that way. And again, this is not a conspiracy. You simply have to go back through the foreign policy statements throughout large parts of the 1990s. That unipolarity was not only good, unipolarity is something that America would try to ensure would remain in being. It had a strategic review in 1993 which said that, and that has been repeated ad infinitum under this administration. So is it secure for eternity? And here I'll try and draw my point. Is it hegemony without contradiction? Point, nice phrase used by Dave Campbell at the University of Newcastle. Well, certainly not. Though how dangerous the threats are to the empire remain to me very unclear, actually. But three, however, do stand out, and I'll be very brief. Firstly, the threats are not of the standard state variety, the standard realist variety, but clearly one part of the problem for the American empire is who shares in the benefit. Of course, there's been much discussion about the globalization crisis, the legitimacy of globalization, and all the rest, which goes back, of course, long before 9/11. So there is, firstly, the question of who gains, who loses. And clearly, much of the discussion and debate going on in Latin America today, particularly in Argentina and Brazil, brings this out very, very forcefully indeed. Secondly, of course, there is a security dilemma for the United States, but this doesn't grow out of growing threats or state threats, rather. There are threats, of course. It doesn't grow out of rising states, but also out of growing resentment of American power itself. We are in a classic situation that America has so much power that the resentment, not surprisingly, against that power is rising throughout the world. Let's be blunt. Nobody likes somebody else who has much more of something they would rather have themselves. I won't call it human nature. I'd simply say it is an international fact of life. This, I think, more than anything else, more than even policies themselves, accounts for growing anti-Americanism in its various manifestations. There is, to some degree, a legitimacy crisis involved here. That is what we are now seeing. That's what I think we've seen over the last week or so with France and Germany. I think that is what we've also seen with extraordinarily large anti-war demos throughout the world over the weekend and in here in London. But partly this was, of course, a statement against the war, but it was also a statement too implicitly about the power distribution. Which brings me finally to the question of hubris. As everybody knows, if they read their Peloponnesian War and Thucydides, all great powers will always go too far and will then suffer the consequences. And here, the usual example stated is that of Vietnam. This was the classic case, not of imperial overstretch, but arrogance, born in the 1960s of too much self-confidence. It then became the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time against the wrong enemy. And the USA lost with long-term results, as we have noted. The same, as is said, could happen again over Iraq. I'm not so sure. Iraq is no Vietnam. Saddam is no Ho Chi Minh. And the Cold War is over. Iraq has no superpower backer in the way that Vietnam did. And to put my neck on the line, the problem might not be Iraq, but what to do after Iraq. Where next? Where to stop? In many ways, given its current outlook, the US may have no choice but to go on. Indeed, it might feel emboldened to do so if the war against Iraq goes well. To conclude, the greatest problem for the new American empire might not be how to defeat Iraq, but what to do thereafter. And how it answers that particular conundrum will impact on all our lives in the years ahead. Thank you very much indeed.
Leave now is a good moment before we usually take questions in clusters of four or five, if that's
sure.
All right.
No, sure.
I make that a talk in five parts, about 147 points, 35 very good jokes.
They weren't bad. They weren't
bad. A few exaggerations here or there.
Oh, my goodness.
Two or three deep structural points and no question marks. So it's plenty, in other words, to get your teeth into. So once we have a little shakeout here, we'll start taking questions.
So my second year students going now, they've got the line.
Okay, whilst they're still clearing at the top, let's take questions down here.
Professor Cox, thank you for a wonderful speech.
Hello.
Throughout American history, we have had the ideas of isolationism and interventionism, if I can define them this way, competing with each other. And these are more often than not internally generated. They have external influence, however, internalized and entering the political space through internal actors. And how does this link to your idea of the American empire might not actually be ending anytime soon or ever? And a related question, do you think, based on your presentation, that the paradigm of interventionism has won irrevocably over the paradigm of isolationism in American public, political, and even social space? Thank you.
My name is Roberto Castaldi. I'm from the Study Center on Federalism of the University of Turin and Pavia. Thanks for the speech. It was worth coming from Italy. You mentioned the reason for the lasting of many empires. The question is, the empires last when they provide public goods for the world, in a sense. Are the United States providing the public goods the world is asking about the new problems, like environmental problems, third world development, all these kind of things? And related to this, the fact that now it seems that the United States is basically using the stick, but doesn't seem to have a carrot in his hand to address the problem of the war. Cannot this be a sign of the difficulties still of lasting of this empire, notwithstanding all the facts you mentioned, in the sense that when an empire works well, it's obeyed without needing to go and make a war. It's obeyed because it's so powerful that everybody is afraid of going against it. It doesn't need to go there. When there is the need to go there, maybe it's already a little bit difficult.
And the view from Europe, William? And then we'll go up to the top.
William Wallace, commenting questions. In the Capitol in Washington, there was a mural which I think was put up in about 1870, which shows the wagons crossing the Western Plains, and the motto underneath is, "Westward the course of empire takes its sway." In the 1870s and 1880s, they were quite happy to talk about empire. They've simply, since Theodore Roosevelt, attitudes have changed. I'd like to follow up on the question of the difference between the way the Americans approached their unrivaled power in 1945 and the way they approach it now, because in 1945 there was this clear sense from Acheson, Kindleberger, etc., that you had to embed American hegemony in a set of liberal institutions in order that you didn't frighten the lesser powers with the amount of power that you had, whereas now the neoconservatives actively reject that. Why do you think there is so much of a difference, and do you think that's one of the fundamental weaknesses in the new American approach? Second, does the current situation, in a sense, parallel, you made the parallel with 1979, what undid the Reagan Revolution was a combination of doubling military expenditure and halving tax income, thus leading to a thumping deficit and to a preoccupation with American declinism. The Bush administration has done that more aggressively in both directions than the Reagan administration did. Do you think that raises very severe problems of where they go from here?
I've got two questions. First one is on America's stance towards Europe, seeing the transatlantic rifts that have suddenly sprung up. I'd like to know what Professor Cox's ideas might be on the future of transatlantic relations and whether Atlanticism in Europe will be on the wane. The other question is, seeing that Iraq has become somewhat of an obsession over the last 12 years in American foreign policy, it seems that American foreign policy, especially since the attacks in September 1, is still predicated upon there being some sort of threat, whether it's an actual credible threat or not. But nonetheless, it seems that, to me, that the whole basis of American foreign policy is hinged upon there being some kind of threat. Therefore, are we heading towards a sort of a permanent war or permanent threat society in the USA?
Okay, in this round, we'll just take one more question up there and then we'll come back for another five. If you can be brief in your responses.
Very quickly, first of all, may I say I'm delighted as a historian, having just published a book, The Final Frontier, which is all about the start of American empire, and is in the shop. But more seriously...
Publisher, price and author, please.
Yes, well, and your question is?
My question is twofold. It's in terms of breaking out of certain constricting ways of thinking. Firstly, against a kind of comparative politics, do we not need now to start looking at how German thinkers such as Carl Schmitt looked at the United States policies in Latin America as a way to do empire, used them as a way to think about German expansion, and then these ideas were in some ways borrowed back across the Atlantic? In other words, do we not now need to break out of the prison of putting German history on one side and American history on the other? First thing we need to break out of. Secondly, it's the question of the internal politics of empire. It seems to me that at this moment it's very vital not to divide the international from the national, and we need to start thinking about the American project of empire as being very much about suppressing the radicalization of democracy within the United States.
That brings us to five questions. Just a couple of footnotes for me, they're not questions. I mean, one, can you just sharpen up for me, maybe just for me, empire? I'm sorry to ask this boring question, but to me, the weight of the concept of empire, if you compare the current American position with the British Empire, is something that was clearly specified in international law in the 18th and 19th century. Empire was essentially effective power through the control of direct control of territory. Now, what contrasts are we making here when the use of the term empire with these former empires that were defined largely through the direct control manipulation of territory? It seems to me what we have here is something that is clearly global and it's hegemonic, but it operates more through process than through the control directly of territory, although, of course, we can argue the case in various places. And the second footnote is to do with power. The whole driving argument about empire is about, in some sense, the singularity of power. But let me just make a point that Joe Nye would make if he were here. He would argue unipolarity in American military power, yes. Economic power, no. Soft power, definitely not. The result is a much greater mess than empire. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Okay, I'll be brief. So if you're still here at 9 o'clock, I'll try. No.
No, we've got to have another five questions.
Okay, so my goodness, sir.
If you've got 2 minutes.
Thank goodness I'm getting a £1,500 fee this evening. What's 1,500?
Don't believe it.
Don't believe it. No, I don't. okay, let me try and address those without being able to deal with everything, because I don't think I have simple answers to all those particular questions. The first question was on isolationism and intervention, the extent to which it was internally generated. And I think the big question there, and I think this is the question which has been asked time and time again, and this again would tell somewhat against my argument, is whether or not, given, if you like, the traditions of isolationism in America, which are not entirely irrelevant, and I wasn't trying to downplay those, or I just didn't talk about them, given also the legacy of Vietnam, which persists, given also that, you know, domestic publics in America, as indeed everywhere else, are generally tend to be more interested in bread and butter issues, whether or not America actually has the domestic basis to maintain the type of empire or the type of global reach that it does. And in a way, I would simply argue that if you'd asked me that question before 9/11, I'd have said no. This is why I think 9/11 is so significant. Because it has simply changed the nature of the debate inside the United States about its role in the world. So I think, in that sense, 9/11, I think, has altered everything. Now, whether 9/11 can alter everything for a very long time remains to be seen. And this, again, is where maybe analogies with the Cold War don't work. You know, after all, the Soviet Union did exist until 1991, you know. The Warsaw Pact did exist until 1989. There were third world genuine revolutions throughout the 70s, which the United States, there was a genuine threat. Whether or not you can sustain the level of domestic mobilization around the issue of international terrorism, and certainly not around the issue of Iraq, remains to be seen. We know at the moment, of course, public opinion runs high on this. Support for the war in America remains high, although if body bags start coming home, that would be something else. So with 9/11, I would say, if that's an answer to the question, I think it has changed everything, though for how long it will change it, I think, is the huge question. Is it an irrevocable victory for intervention? No, I don't think it's an irrevocable victory for intervention. For what it defines as good reasons, it feels it had to do something about Afghanistan, it will have to do something about Iraq. These are specified real problem threats. Does this mean irrevocable victory, that they want to constantly keep going on intervening? I somehow doubt it. If they can manage without intervention, that's far better. I mean, after all, intervention is dangerous. Intervention carries cost, and it's particularly carried a cost for the United States historically. So I don't see this as a gung-ho going on. I don't even see empire as being gung-ho intervention all the time. I'll come back to try and answer the problem about empire later on. I think it's about writing the rules of the game and having the big stick and using it when necessary. And I don't think that therefore means we have an irrevocable victory for intervention. Indeed, as we've seen over the whole question of North Korea, which, by the way, in real terms, is far more of a threat than Iraq, let's be blunt about it. After all, it may even have nuclear weapons and the capacity to hit regional players, such as Japan and South Korea and others. I mean, the United States has been able to do very little. And it will be, in the end, forced back to the Sunshine Policy, which had been working reasonably well. It was the best we had in the 1990s.
So I hope that's an answer to that particular question. I do not see an irrevocable victory for intervention, and I'm not sure that 9/11 will maintain the domestic basis for the types of policies which are being sustained at the moment, although I don't think that undercuts the general argument about empire. That's another issue. You're quite right on this whole issue of public goods. I mean, this is really quite the critical thing. William and I have talked about this, David and myself, many, many others. To legitimize what it does, to effect a consensus internationally about its role in the world, it can't just be seen to be acting alone in the interest of the United States. It has to deliver certain public goods. And the great crisis of the Bush presidency has not been resolved. And that, or the great dilemma or conundrum of the Bush presidency has not been resolved. And we know what that is. It is that before 9/11, in one move after another, it did everything to undermine the idea that the United States was in favor of larger public goods, such as on Kyoto, or on all sorts of things of environment, on joining the International Criminal Court, the rest. And that is its huge conundrum. That is its huge conundrum. But on the one hand, it has its immeasurable and real power, which it is using and deploys, and which frightens people and deters others from acting. On the other, it is acting in such a way which has come under the famous U-term, unilateralism. Fear, however, does work. And I think the American conservatives genuinely believe that in an age of unipolarity, when America has so much power, that what creates order are not international institutions, but fear of power and the ability of the United States to use that power and to deploy that power. Now, I think there's a huge debate going on inside the United States about this. This is only one wing of the discussion. This is not the whole debate. But nevertheless, that debate, for the moment, has been won by those who have argued, as I suggested in my lecture, that the United States just simply doesn't have to sign up to these sorts of things to achieve larger global ends. And I think that, again, is going to, as I said in my lecture towards the very end, raises questions about legitimacy. And I think that will go on. Whether or not the Bush administration can resolve that one, given its own outlook, I simply don't know. And quick response to William Wallace's point, between 1945 and now, it's an interesting contrast. I mean, a number of people have argued against me and said, well, at least in 1945, it wasn't a question of how much power America had, it was the sort of larger general role it could perform. And it could be seen to be working within the larger general interest. This was, of course, the period of talking about empire by invitation. It wasn't exactly as if the US Marines, you know, walked down the streets of Paris or Berlin or Rome and imposed all those Marshall Plan dollars on anybody. Although, to read some people, you'd think they might. And I think there is an interesting comparison to try to think that one through. What is the United States actually doing to try and undermine those types of institutions which embedded its power, and this is, of course, the argument of John Eikenberry, which then made that power acceptable and seemed to be legitimate? Is it what we're witnessing today? And I honestly don't know the answers. Are we witnessing one of those great sea changes, which is far more important than just 9/11 itself? Now, my feeling is that we are. This is why I'm not of the opinion we're just going to carry on as we have done in the past. I think there is a fundamental sea change taking place, and I'm of the opinion that this is going to be fairly long term. And all those, like Eikenberry and many others, who've argued that American power will always be embedded in institutions, and they will always know that it's in their interest, you know, to subsume themselves within those institutions, whatever, I'm not so sure that is true any longer. I think there has been, and whether or not this is generalized for a long time or forever, as somebody once said, an economist said, it's going to take 15 years to get back to the levels where stock exchange prices were in 1999. It's going to take a hell of a long time if we're ever going to return to the type of policies which we normally associate with the United States for a period between 1945 and probably towards the middle of the 1990s. Quickly, I've come back on Reagan and deficits very quickly. That is my own view, and I'm not an economist, and that may mean, therefore, my answer is a better one. I can always make cheap shots at economists because they got so much wrong over the last few years. Hopefully they've got house prices in London wrong as well, by the way. But that's another personal issue. I must say that much of the discussion about deficits, I'm not so sure about deficits. I'm not a neocon, as you know, William, but I'm not so sure that, you know, neocons have not got something right by saying I'm not so sure these fiscal deficits make a great deal of difference. They may make a difference over the very, very long term, but I'm not so sure that it did raise some problems for Reagan, but I'm not sure it undermined the Reagan presidency. And I would still be doubtful whether these deficits, given the size of the American economy, are not handleable. Very quickly on USA and Europe, transatlantic crisis, obviously. NATO is no longer the body it once was. There's no question. I mean, again, I've been of the opinion, there's been those who've said the transatlantic crisis will go on forever and ever and ever. The transatlantic relationship will go on forever and ever and ever. Don't worry. We're all friends together. We share the same values. You know, we all watch the same horrible television shows, blah, blah, blah. I'm simply not so sure. It is quite so secure. I think the old answer that the transatlantic relationship is secure for all those reasons, I'm not so sure about that any longer. And certainly the Americans are not so sure about, and they're certainly not so sure about the role of NATO as a military organization. And that is an important change. Again, on what, you know, learning from German history, well, yes, I agree. I think that all these great imperial powers learn from each other. I mean, the Americans learn from the British, and no doubt many, you know, draw the German, and no doubt even the Japanese example back into it. I do think that form of comparison is really very, very important. Very quickly and briefly, in answer to David's questions, tease out some of these issues. Well, yes, I take all the points. I mean, we can debate this at some length. Why do I call it an empire? Well, it is obviously a different type of empire. I don't doubt that for one second. It doesn't control territory. It is not colonial. It is not certainly not defined in international law. I accept all that. It is a different kind of empire. But I don't mind that, as I said. And as you know, what I was trying to say, there are different forms of globalization as well. There have been different historical modes of globalization as well. What does the United States do, very simply, apart from having the power it possesses? Firstly, it, broadly speaking, shapes most of the rules. It performs the role of international policeman. And it plays a broader role within that world economy which nobody else plays. I mean, the simplest way of measuring that, of course, is that in the end it is American military power which secures oil supplies in the Middle East for Europe and Japan in ways that the Europeans and the Japanese could not do so. Is it messier than empire? Well, yes, but this would be my point against Joe Knight. All those empires were messy as well. I don't think they were quite so clear-cut. We've got sort of views of empires, which I think are slight constructs anyway. And when we go back to look at those empires, maybe they were slightly messy too. They weren't quite so simple, but we still didn't mind calling them empire. Okay. I hope that tries to get some of the issues anyway.
Well, we're running out of time, but there are a few people who want to press on. So I think if it's all right with you, we'll just take a few more moments, just maybe six or seven in total. So I must ask you to ask a question,
and I will be
with one sentence structure or so. No more, please, and no semicolons and colons. Okay, up the top. Where are the microphones? Okay, yeah. Very brief, because we're going to do this very quickly, and we're going to stop in 6 minutes.
Okay, very quick question. What's the difference between a doctrine of preemption and naked aggression?
All right. Answer, very little. That's dealt with. That's a quick one, David.
Thank you. Sorry. My question is, Michael stressed the strength of the United States and sort of poo-pooed a little bit some of the alternatives, you know, that, you know, what happened to economic decline, European alternative, etc. My question is an empire also a sign of weakness? I mean, if you look at the carve-up of Africa, wasn't that part of Britain's decline? An empire is quite often about preventing competitors. Or if you look at, say, George Monbiot in The Guardian on Tuesday, argued it was about economic weakness, the export of capital, a very Leninist remark for an environmentalist. But my question is, what is really the dynamic behind this empire if America is so strong?
In the first months of the current presidency in the pre-9/11 world, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, I believe, said that the ideal U.S. foreign policy would be the one of disengagement, the one maybe leading to the getting involved in countries like ex-Yugoslavia or even the Middle East. How do you see this fitting into the into the empire by invitation theory, and most importantly, what do you think is their current vision right now?
Gentlemen, what should take you in this?
if it is true that intervention is much the same as naked aggression, does that apply equally to humanitarian intervention? Huh. And if not, why not?
And finally?
Professor, very convincingly you destroyed the arguments why we should not use the term empire, but I'm not quite as convinced by your promotion of the term. You mentioned some important historical analogies, but you also pointed to some significant differences. We should obviously use whatever term helps our understanding of the current situation. And is there a risk that using the term empire might actually limit us in our understanding and fails to appreciate the specifics of the situation?
Okay, I'll just...
I'm just scanning the room because it's interesting. Talk of power is uniquely gendered in this room at this time, in a worrying way. So I just want to make sure I haven't missed anyone who wants to ask a question in a non-stereotypically gendered way. But I haven't.
That's enough to silence anybody in the
room. No, I haven't. So all right, I'm sorry. We have to close in just a few minutes.
I'll be brief. I mean, to take the last question first, I mean, if it's empire with the inverted commas around it, or, you know, I mean, clearly the differences exist. Each of those empires had different formations, had different ideologies, had different shapes. I mean, but we can still use a generic term as long as we are well aware of the differences. My argument is, and it gets back to the Ignatieff point, that the denial of it, or in fact the non-use of it, I think prevents us from thinking creatively about this. That's all I'm trying really to argue here this evening. And we lose something by not making those historical analogies. Now, analogies are not designed to always try and find out that things are the same. They're also trying to find out where things are different as well. And I'm not denying any of the differences between the form of the American Empire and all other empires in the past. But I do think that there are useful and important comparisons to be made. One has, of course, to be aware of all the historical and historiographical issues. And one has to be aware that, you know, you use analogies at your risk, and you've got to be careful. But as long as you exercise the right thing, I'm not theologically attached to a particular notion. I simply think it's something very worthwhile exploring. And what is quite interesting about quite a lot of the discussion about empire, the problem is that it's so understudied and under-discussed, although, of course, things have changed, that people actually have not done this sort of work. And I think this is just an important area for historical as well as political research today. Is humanitarian intervention a form of, I'm not quite so cynical as that, no. I mean, I must say, I do not think that what happened in Kosovo was a signal of naked aggression. You know, I don't want to be too flip about this. I mean, some numbers of people were, after all, saved. I mean, one may want to criticize US and European policy in Bosnia and then say it wasn't really an act of humanitarian intervention. Well, go and ask the Bosnians. I'm not sure they saw this as naked aggression. You know what I mean? Well, I mean, one can be pretty cynical about international relations, but I do actually think that there was a particular moment in the 1990s when certain leaders in the world, such as Bill Clinton, actually genuinely did believe that saving humanity was part of what security was about. And let's be honest with you, many of those people have been the biggest critics of the United States in the Cold War, became the biggest supporters of the United States after the Cold War, urging on the United States to intervene more. You know, and I think, you know, many of us, left, liberals and many others, have a deep ambiguity about the United States. You know, we attack it when it doesn't do the things we want it to do, and then we attack it when it does the things it wants to do. You know, I think we have this real schizophrenia about America, which I think maybe we'll never alter. On the question of difference between pre and post 9/11, I think that's a very interesting contrast. If you look at the statements made by the Bush presidency, they were intending to do less, not more. They were intending to intervene less, not more. So, again, I think all this brings up is, well, partly the law of unintended consequence is one of the most important laws of international history. Nobody thought that NSC 68 would get through, but for Korea. You know, I mean, there's a series of major events which come, you know, events, dear boy, as Harold Macmillan once said, and one has to take that into consideration. The only thing I would say is that I think there were many within the Bush administration who clearly did want to do more, who did want to use American power more. And I think 9/11 has provided and opened up a space for them to do. In the same way, of course, it did in the late 1970s for Reagan. Is empire a sign of weakness? Well, I suppose in some very large existential way, it is a sign of weakness. I mean, it's like saying, when you're born, you're about to die. I mean,
You know, I mean, one can say that, but I don't know. I mean, if it's a sign of weakness, then it's a sort of form of weakness that most great powers in history would prefer to have, but not to have, I suppose. Not many great powers in history after all given up empires very, very easily. Even the British, it is said, declined ever so gently and nicely, but even they fought a few good wars to try and slow the process down and then handed on power to those they thought they could actually deal with. Preemption, naked aggression, well, I've already dealt with that. Is there much difference? Of course, there's a certain type of difference. I gave a flip answer. But the question is one of perception. Preemption may be a doctrine for Pentagon for many people out there on the streets of London over the weekend. It is synonymous with naked aggression. And I suppose one of the tragedies, and you might say one of the great conundrums, is that whereas in 9/11, there was clearly a genuine move towards the United States of sympathy, and how rapidly the United States has, in many ways, and for wrong reasons as well as good ones, has thrown much of that sympathy away. And I think that is the great problem for the United States since then. And I'll end there.
Well, the debate continues on the 6th of March, Kagan versus Cooper, the US current position versus European multilateralism, chaired by William Wallace. So we look forward to seeing some, if not all of you, here on the 6th of March. And again, many thanks this evening for analytical and very funny talk.
Thank you.